are now listening to the Film Situation Podcast.
I'm so happy to have Caroline Keene and Dan Kennedy on the Film Situation Podcast. Thanks for joining, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Actually, I had the pleasure of seeing your feature film, Mary Good Enough, on the big screen at Yo-Fi Fest in Yonkers a couple months ago. And before we go down the rabbit hole in the movie, I just want to see if each of you could just do a brief introduction.
Sure. Dan, well, I guess I'll go first. I'm Caroline. I am from Massachusetts. I am a screenwriter. This is the first movie I've ever made, co-directed, obviously with Dan. I studied screenwriting at UT Austin. And yeah, that's kind of my story. Definitely New England person. I live in LA now, but the movie, we'll get to that, is very, very New England. So just
nice.
Yeah, I went to film school and made music videos for many years and a couple of small indie movies. And I met Caroline maybe 6 years ago, and we worked on a few projects together. And here we are now.
Tell us a little bit about the film and how the inception, the whole inception of the film, really.
Yeah, I wrote the movie 2016-ish, 2015, when I was actually in grad school. It really was so long ago. I don't fully remember writing it, but I didn't came fully formed, but I feel like the idea of the mom running away came early, but it was definitely something I hadn't shared with that many people when I shared it with Dan, when I met him in 2017. And he kind of responded to the script pretty quickly and seemed to think it was makeable. And then kind of over the years, we worked on some other things. But yeah, I tend to write in a lot of different genres and different types of movies, but this was probably the most like indie makeable thing I had. And because Dan was close to the movie for kind of years, by the time we actually made it, it was pretty smooth, I would say.
Nice. And you guys co-directed the film. Had you co-directed anything prior to this feature film?
Oh, the first go. Yeah.
Cool.
Dan shot a horror film, more like a psychological thriller called Honeydew, that Sawyer, who's also in Mary Good Enough, Sawyer Spielberg, was in that movie. So we'd work together on that movie, which was like a very all hands on deck situation. So I think that was, you know, neither of us directed it, but it was a type of, thing where we worked with Sawyer and kind of knew it would be kind of a similar experience.
Were you involved in producing the film, Caroline?
I was not, but Dan was.
Okay, cool. Yeah, there's a lot of things I loved about the movie. I don't want to give too many spoilers. This is always kind of the tricky part of the podcast, is talking about it somewhat in depth without really spoiling it. Although I think it's the kind of film where it's such a character-driven film that like somebody could almost know the whole thing and it's still an interesting watch.
I
like how there's a lot of contradiction. It seemed like there's a theme of contradictions. Like even with Lucy, when we first see her in the office scene, she's like, I'm tired of all this Christmas sort of stuff. And that's like her attitude. But yet in the next scene, she's wearing a Christmas hat. Like she's wearing a Christmassy hat. And then she's watching Miracle on 34th Street. Like I actually really appreciated that. How was it really developing the Lucy character?
It's funny because, I mean, I hope that it works, that in the movie doesn't feel kind of silly that she's saying that. And then, you know, yeah, to your point, watching a Christmas movie, I think she's a little not that aware of her love of Christmas. And that's kind of part of what the story is about, is by the end, you realize this person actually loves the holiday.
I think that came across, but it's unraveled. Like as I was watching it, you're still sort of figuring out like, whoa, what's her deal? Like, I like that at first you thought it was going to be one way, and then it's like, oh, okay, this is not actually, you know, which I appreciate, because there's so many films you could like predict every single thing that's going to happen. And this was definitely not one of those sort of movies, you know?
Thank you. I think, and Ray Levine is just so incredible in the movie. And I think she's really just someone who like can't really get out of her own way, including like realizing, you know, that she actually likes the holiday. So she's like bringing all this kind of negative energy, because I think she's like afraid to enjoy it. We like are living with her fears they'll happen. So I think her like fear of Christmas not going well turns into it originally or initially not going well. Yeah, I think I always just thought of her, I think it's in the script. Well, she's called a Scrooge, and that she kind of is a Scrooge, but like a lovable Scrooge. We're still rooting for her, I think, I hope.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's how I felt for sure. And for the family in general, it's the interesting dynamics between the family and the siblings. And, you know,
yeah,
I thought there was good chemistry with the characters as well.
Yeah, we got so lucky. I mean, every single actor in the movie, it's like, we're the directors, of course, you think they're amazing, but they really like individually are so strong. And then their chemistry together is like the most fun. I mean, I've obviously seen the movie a ton, and I still like laugh and enjoy their dynamics. And I think even in the very beginning of the movie, the brother played by Daniel Desmarais, you think, does he even like his sister? Like, he's not going on the errands with her. His energy is kind of unique and maybe a little low, but then you realize like how much he loves her and how much they kind of get along. And it was just fun to watch the actors be able to play all those different, you know, layers and angles.
And what was the original sort of motivation for you? I know you said it was back in 2015, and kind of it's hard to remember. And if you could think back to what was kind of the impetus for like this sort of film.
Yeah, I think, and it's in our like initial kind of brainstorming decks and stuff, that I was Squid and the Whale is one of my favorite movies.
The Noah Baumbach, it's great.
Yeah. And I remember, I have like a vivid memory of seeing that movie in theaters, actually with my brother, feeling like I'd never really seen something like that before. A movie about divorce, but it was very funny, but also sad. So there was like that kind of tone I was interested in, but then at the same time, I love Home Alone and sort of these like more classic Christmas movies. And I think I wanted to try to blend the two. So that for sure.
I think it was a good blend, actually. And it's funny you mentioned Home Alone, because I was just showing it to my daughter, who's 5 years old. And, you know, it's like a movie I loved when I was a little kid. And I think it still holds up pretty well, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also like kind of intense. Like, I think that's what's also so interesting about that movie. Like, I don't know if I remember it as a kid noticing it, but when you watch it now, like the scene where he fights with his mom at the beginning is like really intense. And
yeah, it is, actually.
Yeah. So I always appreciated that about the movie, because I think it makes like when they reunite at the end so wonderful. And the idea that you can like make something that's entertaining and fun, but that there's still these kind of like very real raw emotions in it, was definitely something that Dan and I talked about a lot. And the actors were like super, you know, keyed into that dynamic of the film. We didn't even really have to talk about it a lot once we were filming, that we were kind of playing in both of those spaces.
How many shooting days did you guys do this in?
I'll let Dan answer that.
Yeah, we shot it over a few weeks.
Like 20 days-ish?
Yeah, it was around 20 days.
Okay.
Yeah. We moved fast. It didn't feel like overly stressful. I think the actors were so prepared, and we got really lucky with our locations and just with kind of the cohesiveness of our whole team working together. So even though we did a lot every day, it didn't feel like crazy, or I mean, some days did, but
I mean, I love some of the specificity in the film. There's a lot of really specific moments, like when it cuts into the ice rink and with the dad just talking about, you know, in Kosovo, you can't even afford a condo. Just like that kind of stuff I really enjoy.
Well, that line is improvised by Joel Murray, who's the greatest man in the world. But I will share that. So when we were scouting for the movie, the rink scene was always in the film, but the scene of him tying the skates wasn't. But when we went into the rink, that space was so awesome that it was like, we have to have a shot in this here. And then one of my favorite parts of the movie is when he's tying the skates and Daniel looks down at his dad. So that was a fun like adjustment, you know, we're just going to add like this little moment because we have the space.
Yeah, they're great. I really like the dad, and just like how he's introduced. He really just explodes on the screen as soon as he's there. He's such a presence. in the film.
Yeah, it was written that way in the script, and then when we got to see Joel do it, it was so cool. And he actually came, you know, maybe 8 to 10 days into the shoot is when he started on set, so like it felt that way.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
you guys shot pretty much in sequence.
Didn't necessarily shoot in sequence, but we definitely somehow ended up, you know, getting his days a little more compressed.
Right. That makes sense.
You know, when I watch the movie, I'm like, there's a dynamic with the siblings when it's just them that I love. But yeah, the moment Joel enters the movie, it kind of really starts. I mean, he's like such a dynamic actor, and he's incredible.
What was some of the most difficult part of the shoot?
I think post-production was probably the most difficult. The shoot itself, there were, you know, a lot of things came up and there were a lot of fire drills, but everything I think went pretty smoothly. It was a great experience.
Nice.
Yeah. I think like, I was gonna say the lead up to shooting, which at least for me, like years of just trying to wrap my head around so much stuff. And then I found post-production, like, it's just the length of it is so much longer than the shooting, that sort of, there are elements of that were difficult. But the shoot itself, I mean, Dan has made a few movies before, so I think that obviously really helped and helped me. I think I don't remember, like, you know, you're moving so fast. The scene at the end between the mom and the daughter is so critical. It wasn't like in the moment I was like, oh gosh, this has to work, but in a way that kind of movement and the third act is so important, and that we actually shot pretty early. So I remember feeling like I don't know if this is working or not. It wasn't going badly. I just didn't know.
Yeah, there's that uncertainty. That makes sense, especially if you're shooting at a sequence,
and
and when you're watching the film as an audience, there's supposed to be that build up. I can imagine the uneasiness about that for sure. I've been in those kind of situations.
Yeah.
And then I shot a feature film where I made a mistake of shooting. We had to end up reshooting a scene, and looking back, I'm like, that was insane that we were shooting the graveyard. We were attempting to shoot the graveyard scene on the first day of production. Like, that's such a, that wasn't like dipping our toes into the water. It was like just, just plunging in without anything. And it was a scene that and I hate doing reshoots more than anything, but sometimes they're necessary. Did you guys have to do any reshoots whatsoever on anything?
No, we didn't. We didn't reshoot anything. Did we, Caroline? Certainly not after the shoot. I'm trying to think if we did any.
Yeah.
Shot anything over again during it, but
we did have a version of in the movie when, well, I guess like there's a scene at the very, very end with Joel talking to the daughter on the couch, and the brother comes in the house, and that was kind of something we realized at the last minute we needed. There was just this like little baby scene that was like, it's going to be a little confusing narratively to not have this. So thankfully we were able to kind of like adjust at night and think about the next day and like, is there something we don't have in there? But I will say, like, if Dan scheduled the movie so well that like the first day we shot was just Ray, the lead, and the kind of walking around Boston and all the stuff that's in the opening of the movie. So there was that, like, we were able as like a team to kind of like ease in through that. Ray was able to kind of, you know, she's in like every scene. Well, she's actually not in every scene of the movie, but she's in a lot of it. And so that was really cool. And I think saving some of the huge stuff for the second week, third week was critical.
What was the scene that was the funnest to shoot?
I think the whole dance charades sequence was like so fun. We were pretty far into the shoot at that point. They were all like having a really good time. I was like laughing pretty hard. They're not fully playing though. Like, there was a couple things that they were told to do, but then at some points they actually are playing charades. So that was fun. And they're all obviously so funny. I also really loved filming the scene in the bar. It was just so exciting to have Neil Casey be in the movie. And then like, that was one of the scenes that looked and felt so much like I'd imagined it, that it was like just really cool to have happen.
Yeah, he was a great character in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the bar scenes a lot.
So fun. That was definitely my favorite scene to shoot as well. I mean, they were all a blast, but that came at a good time in the schedule too, to have that sort of like emotional break and just laugh for a while.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what did you guys, what was the shooting format of the film? What did you guys, what kind of camera, kind of lenses?
Yeah, we shot on digital Alexa LF with Leica lenses.
And what was kind of, I'm sure you get asked this a lot, what was kind of the division of labor between both of you directing? Like, what was the dynamic of that?
Dan, do you want to have a time?
I mean, Caroline's really good with story. So we would sort of start, we'd talk about a scene and how we wanted it to look and feel together. And then she would start out working with the actors, and I'd start out working with the visual team. And then we'd flip-flop as needed after we did a couple takes.
It was over a year ago, but it was pretty seamless, I felt. I think Dan has so much more experience with the camera because he's a cinematographer, and just in general. So that was definitely more of a division. But then I'd say working with the actors was like pretty balanced, certainly, especially like once we were in the scene. I had done like some work with them, being the screenwriter with like prep in terms of, and each actor was different. Some of them really wanted to get into the backstory of the character and some didn't care at all. But that, I would work with them on. But then when we were actually filming, it was pretty like seamless in terms of, someone having an idea or a change or something. It wasn't like, just kind of flowed. And then certain scenes more than others, I think Dan and I would work before we started shooting, and then like, the day of or the night before of like, this is what we're going to do. And then certain scenes, it was like, we did exactly that. And other scenes we didn't, because, either someone had a different idea or something new was happening. But it was pretty, I found it pretty easy.
Would you do a lot of takes?
We didn't do that many takes. We didn't really need to. The actors were really dialed. A lot of times when we did new takes, it was just to experiment with a different avenue, but we weren't, cranking out.
Like you already had what you needed, and you were just kind of trying it a different way just to have it.
Yeah, it felt like, again, it's my first film, but like I felt like we were like right in the middle of the, like, it wasn't like you only get one take, but it also wasn't like we're just going to be here all day.
It wasn't like a David Fincher, like we're doing 100.
Yeah. So there was definitely like most days we were doing like 2 to 3 major scenes. So there was a time constraint. But to Dan's point, the actors were so good. I mean, there were like certain scenes where it was like, even if we had more time, the dinner scene with Joel and the three kids at the table, like, they were all so locked in and great that it was like, I think we have it, things like that. I'm trying to think if there were certain days where we, or certain scenes that we kind of took our time or breathe, but usually it was like three or four takes.
How long did the diner scene take to shoot? Was that like an all day shoot?
45 minutes.
45 minutes? No way.
No, I mean, 3 hours.
I mean, we did the diner scene the same day we did, was it the Christmas store? Christmas tree store?
Yeah, it was the bar scene in the morning to the diner, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, we shot the bar scene with Neil in the morning, and then we went and shot the diner after that.
You guys did a company move on the bar scene and the diner scene? That's incredible.
Yeah, that was
vicious.
Were
they like right next door to each other?
I think pretty close.
Maybe, yeah, 40 minutes, maybe.
40 minutes? That's not that close. I don't consider that close at all.
40 minutes in Mass,
That's true. It's different. I've noticed that because I was telling my grandfather lives in the Bronx. And as you know, I'm moving up to New Hampshire. And he's like, oh, how far away are you from my brother has a place in Vermont. I was like, oh, like half an hour away. In my head, I'm like half an hour away, which is like super close. He's like half an hour away. so far.
Not in the city.
Yeah, I don't consider half an hour up there, especially that far at all. But yeah, so that makes sense. It's all relative, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and like, it's almost, you know, if I look back on it and like one of the actors hadn't been prepared, it would have been a huge problem. But that they were just so in their characters, and like, I even in the diner scene, I mean, it's mostly scripted, but they're riffing a little bit. And like, I think they felt like they had the freedom and the time to riff, even though we were like, you know, we don't have that much time.
No, I really liked that scene, actually. And yeah, I really liked the characters. It was a good character-driven film. I really enjoyed watching it. What's going on with the movie? Are you guys in the festival circuit? Are you in the distribution phase?
Yeah, the movie is out. It came out on December 19th, so it's on most of the VOD platforms. Nice. Yeah, anyone can watch it. If you're in the mood for a Christmas film in February, I think it'd be fun.
People often are in the mood for a Christmas.
Yeah, like it's an evergreen holiday. Sorry, no, I just said holiday. It's an evergreen family dramedy that can be enjoyed at any time of the year. Just happens to have a lot of Christmas music in it. I feel like it's a cold weather movie. Like, it's probably not something you're going to want to watch like in June, but there's something about it that I think is not just a Christmas movie. You know, we always kind of felt like, certainly, you know, the actors and the sort of, it's just a movie that happens to be set at Christmas about this family. You know, I would watch this family on Memorial Day. I'd watch them on like a normal weekend in March, but this is just when the story happens to take place. So yes, it's available to rent or buy right now. And we're hoping this coming Christmas, it'll get kind of find another new audience of people.
Nice. And you guys have been to a bunch of festivals as well. I met the two of you at Yo-Fi Fest in Yonkers. How's the festival circuit been? Has it been a fun ride or what?
It was short for us. We did, you know, we shot the movie only a year ago in December, and then we premiered it at the New Hampshire Festival in October, and then we saw you at Yofi, and then it came out the next month. So we really,
that's pretty good. That is a really impressive turnaround for an independent film.
It was fun. Yeah. We just got on the wave and kept going.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was only two festivals, but super fun, super like rewarding to watch it with big crowds.
I think that's better. I think it's better to, you know, I don't know. I used to blitz my films out to a lot of festivals, but I think it's, I don't know. I think it's quality over quantity. You know, yeah, as far as the festival experience goes.
We had a really good experience at both those festivals. And then we did, I think, maybe 12 to 15 screenings at smaller independent theaters with Q&As. And those went really well.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Did a film anthology in New York. And
yeah, that's great.
Chicago was really cool. Joel went out for that and did a Q&A.
Nice.
Yeah, and a handful of others in Mass.
Yeah, and that was after the film was fully finished.
Yeah, that was right after we saw you at Yofi. We started doing that little, we're calling it the North American tour.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah.
Yeah, it really was like, you know, cramming into a van, and we were kind of all just like, the cast has been so passionate about the movie, which is, you know, we feel so lucky. So they were down to go to all these screenings, and we got to do one in Chatham in Cape Cod, where Comfort Clinton, who's plays Cynthia, the sister in the movie, is from. That was a really great crowd and special event. And we showed it out in Long Island, where one of our producers is from, and Sawyer has a connection out there. So we were kind of going all over, and it was great.
She did such a great job playing. Before it was announced that she was an attorney in the film, I was like, she's definitely a lawyer. Because I've worked with a lot of lawyers, and I've done a lot of client work for a lot of attorneys. And I feel like she had the mannerisms of, like, just even the way that she was handling her luggage and just.
Oh, yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, she did a fantastic job. Oh, the whole cast did, actually.
Yeah. She, that role was like, you know, and I wrote it, could like kind of veer into cliche, but I always knew that this person was very intelligent, that would, you know, and Comfort is so smart and intense in her own way. And so I just like feel like she is so believable as like, you're like, oh, this woman like does have a much more intense and powerful job than her siblings and like kind of lives in a slightly different world than them. And yet is still so magnetic and like, you know, she's a great comedic actress who's also really intelligent. And I think it's a hard role, and she also like, you know, and because we did shoot some things out of order, or maybe we didn't, because Dan was so good at the schedule, but I feel like her arc in the movie is really nice. Like she really is comes in so hot and like kind of like, ugh. And then by the end, you just realize all this emotion she's carrying, and I love watching her. So.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I felt like that as an audience as well. You know, I felt it's like, oh, she's having her sister carry her luggage. She's, you know, she came across a certain way, but you're definitely get emotionally invested in her character as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was an ad lib that Comfort did with the roll that about her bag.
Oh, really? Nice. Yeah. Do you guys have a lot of improvisation, a lot of ad libs?
The scripts, there's certain scenes that weren't ad libbed at all, probably like most of the more dramatic ones, but there was a lot of freedom for them to riff. And there's like some of the best lines in the movie I didn't write. Joel's obviously a brilliant improviser. Daniel is so funny. Ray is like a really gifted physical comedian, which I didn't really realize right away. So she has like just some stuff she does that wasn't written, like playing with salt. Dan, I don't know if you can think of any.
Ray is so good at even a lot of the nonverbal stuff, yeah. Because I feel like film is a medium where really somebody can convey their thoughts. And I feel like a lot of the times, just in her mannerisms and her facial expressions, you really understand her frame of mind in that moment as the character.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Totally. You can really feel what she's feeling without her telling it to us.
Yeah.
No.
So that's always impressive.
Yeah. Joel has some, you mentioned the diner scene, and he has this like line about a corgi as big as a schnauzer. That was just him ad-libbing. That always makes me laugh. And you can hear Daniel laughing. And I think that's just genuine, like, because he's just like laughing at what Joel Murray is saying, because it's so ridiculous.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just love some of the super specific things of how it's just like ultra relatable. Like when they first go to the mom's house and she asks her if she wants some salad, she's like, I have 3 bags of arugula. That's about to go bad.
yeah, that was written. Oh, yeah. We haven't talked about Susan Gallagher, who plays the mom. She's incredible. And
a tough sort of role to, I'm sure that was a tough role to cast, because it's so specific.
Yeah. And it's so easily like could be done wrong.
Right. And, like, right. I can see that.
She was so good at making this character and this woman really dynamic. And you could like see many different things that were going on with her. And then she has to be there, and she has to make enough of a presence in those really just like 3 scenes. And then she's gone for a lot of the movie. And, you know, she's like, her missing is like the engine of the plot and sort of all of Ray's emotions and all these things. And so you have to really care about that woman. And I think, yeah, Susan is just so funny, but also really interesting to watch and really grounded and strong. And she was wonderful.
Nice. And the dynamic between Lucy and Sam, I thought was really good. And it wasn't like typical. It wasn't like, oh, here's what's going to happen. And it's exactly like every other movie. It was like, I feel like it was unique and pretty cool. And I know they're married in real life. And I only know that from meeting them at the festival.
Yeah, they are. I don't really know how they were able to perform it the way they did so well, you know, given how well they know each other. So it was really special to get to see that.
Sawyer is wonderful in the movie too. And somebody who watched it said to me like how he's so different than the siblings, his energy. And it's so true. Like what he brought to that character was just sort of this kind of like openness and lack of sarcasm, and just sort of like, he's really good at listening, like as an actor, as a person. Like it's just his presence in the movie is so interesting and unexpected, where you're like, what is really going on here?
Yeah, there's a lot of depth there, and it felt very real. It's funny because you guys are playing with the trope that it could be on paper like a Hallmark movie, but it's not like that at all when you watch it. It's, you know, it's maybe not on paper. Maybe that's the wrong.
But
yeah, yeah. Like, so I don't want to be disparaging in any way. Like, but I just mean, like, when people think of holiday films, sometimes they think of that, and it's like, oh no, this is not that. And you see it right away. You know, you see that, you know, in the first couple of minutes of the film. So I think you guys did a great job of like playing with like the holiday trope, but not, it wasn't, you know.
No, totally. I know what you mean.
Overly sentimental in any, you know, in that sort of way.
Girl went home for Christmas and, you know, fell in love with her neighbor from when she was young.
Right, right. Exactly. And then it's like they live happily ever after. And then that's it. You know, like there's no dimension. There was a lot of depth, a lot of like with all the characters. And I felt like each of the performers brought so much to the table. And I personally like films that reward repeat watchability. And I saw the film at the festival. I enjoyed it. And then I watched it again. And I'm like, oh, there's little things that I picked up that I didn't even pick up the first time. Or, you know, just like even the dynamic with the mom's friend, I think it was the gym teacher that they see at the diner, and then they go to his house. And, you know, like, it's like I had an impression of that character the first time I saw the film that was a little different than when I revisited the film, you know?
Oh, that's really cool to hear.
Yeah, there's just like, you know, just little moments that I picked up on that I'm like, oh, I didn't really, it's kind of interesting, you know, seeing it that way. And like I said, it wasn't a film where I'm sure you guys watch so many things, and Caroline, you as a screenwriter, you're like, okay, now here a problem is going to happen, and they're going to resolve it. And, you know, you could predict like almost everything that's going to happen. And this wasn't one of those kind of movies at all.
Yeah. I think Caroline did a really interesting job of like setting things like that up and then going a different way. So.
Yeah. Super cool, guys. Yeah. It's an incredible accomplishment.
Thank you.
Pulling it off.
Yeah. I give all the credit to the actors. Like, I think, you know, the movie, now that it's done, it's easy to be like, you know, I noticed this or that, but you don't know when you're right. It's almost like, you know, and if we get to make another movie, like the actors, I feel like they all brought something different, where the movie becomes more than just like Lucy's movie, and right. You the dimension. And because we did so many screenings, you know, I was noticing things that I don't even know that I knew we were doing when we filmed. Like Joel's performance is so interesting, because there's like certain times I can watch it where I'm like, oh God, what is he saying or doing, and it's not very nice or whatever. And then other times I'm like feeling so much emotion. You know, Daniel plays the brother, same thing. There's just like different things that they all brought so much nuance. So I just feel so grateful for all of them.
Nice. Yeah. It sounded like you guys had a good time making it as well. That's nice to hear as well. Cause the two don't always correlate. I always say there's four scenarios. Like you have a good shoot and you get good stuff. That's the best case scenario. Then the second best case scenario is it's a rough shoot, really rough shoot, but you get good stuff. And then it's like the third scenario is it's a good shoot, but you don't get good stuff. And then obviously the worst scenario is bad shoot, bad
stuff.
Stupid
stuff. Yeah. I did just hear recently, I don't even know where, somebody said something about Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt. Like the rumor is they didn't like each other during Twister, and it was like and I was like, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to know that. I mean, you can't tell watching the movie, but
that's
always fascinating to me. We were lucky there were no huge feuds happening on set. So
that's good. Yeah. Good. There was good vibes.
Yeah.
So is there anything before we move to the second phase of the podcast where we talk about favorite scenes, is there anything else that you wanted to share about the movie? Where could people check it out? You mentioned it's on streaming. It's on, I guess, all streaming platforms, or it's available for rent.
All the verbiage is confusing. It's available to rent or buy multiple ways right now. So you could rent it or buy it on Apple, on Amazon, on Dish, Spectrum, you know, almost like any place you would go to rent or buy a movie. It's not included right now in a streaming service. That's our, you know, our hope for this coming Christmas is that it might be on like a Netflix or a Hulu or something, but we'll see. But right now you can go rent it, buy it today, kind of anywhere you would rent it or buy any movie.
Cool.
Yeah.
And are there any other thoughts that you wanted to share about the film or we?
Yeah. One thing that, you know, Dan's camera's off, but it's just so beautifully shot, I think. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that. So I think
it's very well shot.
Kind of to your point, it's like, you know, it's a Christmas film, but there's some other stuff going on in it, both emotionally and visually. And then I always like to give a shout out to our music supervisor. The movie, you know, was small and we made it quickly and kind of run and gun, but I think the music is a huge part of, along with the actors and, you know, everything that elevates it a little bit. And it's just something I love about it. So I'd like to call it out.
I was listening to the Roger Deakins podcast. Actually, it's a great podcast. I don't know if you guys have ever heard it. And Roger Deakins is obviously the famous cinematographer that works with the Coen brothers a lot. And I guess he was talking about just working most of the time, just working with them. They were always on the same page. But he said there was an early film, I think, Barton Fink, where Joel Coen was like, you know, I really like this shot on a 50 millimeter lens. Throw a 50 millimeter lens on it. And then he went to go get coffee. And then Ethan Coen was like, I think this is a good shot, but it should be on a 100. Put it on a 100. I doubt it doesn't sound like there was those kind of moments with you guys. It sounded like you were pretty on the same page.
We're mostly in post.
No, we had plenty of that. I think we had a like unwritten rule that whoever cared more about something won.
That's a good rule.
Won the discussion, not the argument.
Right. I see what you're saying.
I think one thing I learned is like you know, once you move on from a scene of editing it, it's, I'm like, oh, I don't even remember being annoyed. I can't even, you know, remember what I was like so fixated on, because once it works. So I felt like, you know, there was this few scenes where we might've had very different views, but mostly it was the same. And if it was really like something where we thought actually it should start with this shot or whatever, this scene's too long, or usually in retrospect, I was always very lucky to have another point of view or to have Dan say, this just like should be this way or whatever. And you know, that makes it better in the long run.
Did you guys shot list it, storyboard it, using floor plans? What was kind of like the
yeah, we did
like for that?
Pretty heavy shot listing. And then obviously on the day, if something spoke to us, we'd capture that.
Nice.
Yeah. But
I'm not the biggest fan of storyboards personally.
Right.
Kind of like,
because things change, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to see how the actor is gonna. Obviously, if you had like endless rehearsals, I could see it. I can see it being useful. It's useful in commercials for sure.
Yeah.
But
actually, heavy action stuff, it's useful for
how the actors are gonna react to a space for me, and then figuring out, you know, how our plan can capture that is.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's actually nice for somebody with a cinematography background to hear that, because there's a lot of cinematographers that like, you can't move your face even half an inch.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to know like what's more important in a scene, and this is definitely a acting heavy movie, so
for sure
capture it.
All right, well, we are going to move to the second portion of the podcast where I ask each guest what are some of their favorite movie scenes of all time. Sometimes it gets tricky because people think it's an absolute. You guys were pretty quick to respond, though. Some people really get stuck on the question and like, I have to think about this for days and days. Both of you, thanks to both of you for being pretty quickly responsive on it, because I always say you don't have to think about your most absolute favorite movie scene of all time, although feel free to let us know if it is, but just any scene that you really like or resonates with you. I guess, Caroline, we'll start with you. You mentioned a couple scenes. One was from Silver Linings Playbook, which I love that film. I've seen it numerous times.
Same. I feel like that movie definitely had a big influence on me. Most movies I love, I don't really know at the time that it did. And then, you know, as I started thinking more about making this movie, I kept returning to the sort of tone of that movie. I'm a huge Bradley Cooper fan. Bradley, if you're listening, I think he's the best. And
have you seen the new film that he directed and starred in about Leonard Bernstein?
Yes. Yeah. I liked it a lot.
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. I saw it in the theater. I feel like that always, I like seeing movies in theaters. A lot of people I know who are like, oh, I don't know, they watched it at home. And I'm like,
I like going to the theater as well.
Yeah. If you can, I don't know if it's still out. But yeah, I mean, I love obviously Robert De Niro, but I feel like in that movie, he's in Silver Linings. It's an ensemble. I've always loved ensembles. And it's also just so fun. Like that's a movie that I'm going to rewatch it anytime I can. Like, so yeah. that was something.
Okay. So I guess we'll give some context of the film with this. I always say that I should have a spoiler alert button for this part of the podcast. There will be spoilers. So for people that haven't seen any of the films that we're talking about, even if you hear what we're talking about, you should go out and see these films still. So yeah, Silver Linings Playbook. It's about a guy that I guess he's had a mental breakdown and is returning from basically coming back home. And he's like, I guess supposed to be around 30 years old in the film and mm-hmm. coming back to live with his parents. And his dad is a major football fan, Philadelphia Eagles, like diehard fan. And that's something that him and his father bond over. And he meets somebody that in his neighborhood, played by Jennifer Lawrence. I guess talk about the scene a little bit, Caroline. Give us some context to the scene and what you love about the scene.
Yeah. And so, and the truth is, I've always loved that scene. I hadn't watched it in a long time, but I think when I rewatched it, I was thinking about Mary Goodenough and like kind of looking at some of the notes that Dan and I had shared going into it. And it's like, our movie, it's very natural in the sense of basically Robert De Niro enters his grown son's room, who's been like napping, and he sits down and he's just saying, you know, we should watch the Eagles game. He's just talking about football, and then he kind of just like goes into this other conversation that's like much deeper and bigger than that. But I think whether it's the acting or the writing or both, it seems to almost catch both of them off guard. And he's just talking about their relationship when he was a child, their relationship now. And like, I'm gonna start crying right now, but I just remember when the first time I saw it, I was so moved. And Bradley Cooper is just listening in the scene. He actually doesn't talk, which is pretty fascinating too. And I just love the scene. I love the acting. I love it.
It's one of those films where when I first saw the film in the theater, it was like I had forgotten how good De Niro was, because it was like, whoa, De Niro turned it on for this movie. You know, I'm not saying he phoned it in for every, you know, for movie, but you know what I'm saying? Like there's a lot of movies where I feel like it was written to be almost like a caricature, where he's playing like almost like a caricature of himself. And this movie was not like that. It was just really amazing acting.
Yeah.
And
he was nominated. He should have won. But I feel like people also, they kind of overlooked that, because he also has done so much other good stuff, but it's actually, he's quite subtle in this movie.
Less is more sometimes. Yeah, it's, yeah. I think subtlety is important,
yeah,
especially in cinema.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it was a very real, it felt like a really real character. And there's definitely people that have those kind of intense superstitions. And then he's also mentioning like this football stuff. It's kind of, so wait,
yeah,
it's a way for us to spend time together.
And yeah.
He's being really real with his son. And that's something that fathers and sons, but what you remember those moments, you know?
I think he's not, I have to rewatch it again, but I don't even think he's like looking at him when he's talking. Which is interesting.
And I think I went to a Q&A actually of that movie where the director David O. Russell was there. He was in New York, and some of the cast, a lot of the cast were there. Not Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper, but I know like Julia Stiles was there. There's a bunch of people there, and they were answering questions, and he was talking about the process of making the film. David Russell was, and he's a director that I know he really builds his movies in the edit bay. A lot of the takes, he really encourages the actors to do wildly different stuff. And it was interesting to hear his process. Yeah, I thought that movie was great. Love Jennifer Lawrence's character in the film as well.
Yeah. She's so great.
I have a buddy, my friend Daniel Lear, who was in California. I produced on some of his projects. And for some reason, he always says that I remind him of Robert De Niro. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, you remind me of Robert De Niro in Silver Linings Playbook. And he sent me the scene where Jennifer Lawrence, he's saying to Jennifer Lawrence, he's like, I got to think about this. I got to say, I like her now. So I must have said that to Daniel on different things. I'm like, I got to say, Daniel, blah, 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 you know? And it's funny for some reason he says, I don't see it for myself, but he's like, he sent me the link to that scene. So it's funny that you mentioned that, because a couple of months ago, he'd sent me the link to the other scene where they're talking about the parlay and Jennifer Lawrence is there. And he's like, I didn't trust her before, but now I got to say, now I do.
That's what I like. Yeah. It's a great, and that's a movie that when you first watch it, I think you're like, oh, you know, the movie's about Bradley Cooper and his struggles. And when you rewatch it, you see more what's going on with the dad, and that, you know, they're more alike in certain ways. And, you know, it's like, that to me is kind of fascinating. And also kind of, I think it's just great, great, great flick.
Great, great film. So yeah, if somebody hasn't seen, if they haven't seen Silver Linings Playbook and they're listening to this podcast, it's like, stop the podcast and just go watch that movie for sure. Yeah. And Dan, you mentioned Me, You, and Everyone We Know. That's an indie film that I haven't seen since the time it came out. Although it did make a strong impression on me when it came out, but I revisited the film. That's actually one of the things that I love the most about this podcast is kind of,
oh, I bet, just
watching movies and then revisiting films that I might not normally see. And yeah, indie film starring Miranda, written and directed by Miranda July. And I gotta say, I forgot how cinematic the film was. It's funny how like you think of a film a certain way. I was like, oh, it's like a really small indie film, but a really small indie film could be incredibly cinematic.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think I'm pretty sure it was one of the first like movies that was shot digitally too, wasn't it?
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Pretty sure they shot it digital.
They did a great job. Because I assumed just from the time period that it was shot on film, because it looked pretty filmic.
Well, the movie's so good that people have asked me about the cinematography in it. I'm like, oh, you know what? I don't even know.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I guess let's talk about the scene, the goldfish scene. So give some context.
Yeah, sure. So she's an artist driving a, you know, sort of makeshift cab for work on the side, and she's spots a dad and her daughter, and they are leaving a pet store, and they accidentally leave a goldfish in a bag on the roof of their car. And then,
well, you guys have that's funny, because you guys have a coffee cup on the roof of the car scene.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, I just thought about that.
I actually thought that too when Dan sent that scene through. I mean, I've seen the movie, I've watched it.
I,
I was like,
I love the fact too that the mom in your film doesn't get. I just love. She's like, "Oh, that's a cup of. It's my coffee. Don't even worry about it."
Yeah, like the polar opposite reaction to, as in me and everyone we know. But
yeah,
yeah, and they just make this super heightened, sort of moody, wild scene about the meaning of life and just kind of following the plight of this goldfish, and they're trying to get the attention of the guy driving the car and trying to get him to stop, and then the score eventually comes in and builds, and the score of the movie is beautiful.
I love the score. Yeah,
it's something I listen to.
I gotta look that up, but they did a great job. It's very specific.
Yeah, it's, yeah, he, I mean, it's, I think it's my favorite movie score, that and Ain't the Body Saints. Those are probably my two favorite movie scores.
That's a good movie as well.
Composer, dude?
Daniel Hart is the Ain't Them Bodies. Yeah, I mean, that's basically the scene. You know, they're just staring at this fish riding.
The tension of the bag of goldfish, and then they're trying to, then it falls in the car in front of them on the trunk of the car, where there's a couple driving that car, and unbeknownst to them, there's the goldfish. So then they try to drive in front to sort of box it in. So then the dad that originally had the goldfish, he sees it. And yeah, it was good. It was a great scene. And it seemed like it must have been challenging to film that. That's what I was thinking as I was watching it.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's like, I watched so many movies, and I'll just, you know, annoy the hell out of my wife talking about the lighting or the cinematography or something. And I couldn't even tell you, you know, that I thought about how they shot any of this movie, just because I get so sucked in every time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was, and Caroline, you haven't seen that film?
I have, but only once.
Gotcha.
What I'm remembering from it is the male actor, Hawks.
John Hawks, yeah, he's John great. Hawks.
Yeah, he made an impression on me. Like, I'm remembering certain scenes, but not.
Yeah, yeah.
I rewatched it and dancing it through.
Yeah, I really liked his performance in the film as well.
I saw it. I'm skewed too, because I had one of those experiences where this happened with Good Time for me too, where.
I love that movie. Good
Time. Yeah. Like a theater, and saw it in, I think, 2005 or 2006 when it came out. Not Good Time, me.
Right, know. Right.
And there was no one else there, so I just got to stay in a theater alone and watch it.
I saw Licorice Pizza like that.
Yeah, it's
cool. I need to watch it.
Yeah, it's such a like unique experience, especially when you're watching like a mood film like this.
Yeah. Yeah, there were so many good moments of that movie. So it was fun to rewatch that.
Yeah, if anybody missed it, they should definitely watch that, because it was, you know, it's definitely a smaller movie that came out, I guess, 20 years ago almost.
It's wild to think about 2005 is 20 years ago. It is. Caroline, you also mentioned Apollo 13. That's a cinematic classic as well. Directed by Ron Howard. And there's a scene where Gary Sinise's character finds out he can't go to space.
Yeah. That's definitely one of my favorite movies of all time. And the fact that I don't own it, because I Googled it after, but like I have to find the scene. I'm going to buy the movie now. I'm like, how do I not own it? My memory of the scene is that when it starts and you cut in, there's these men sitting in chairs and the camera's like moving slowly. I don't know if it's one take, but basically he's processing that he's not gonna be able to go up, and it's all silent. They're just sitting and waiting for him to talk. It's like almost as if the discussion's already happened and he's just processing it. But I saw that movie. It's probably the movie I remember most vividly seeing in theaters. Like, I was in fourth grade and I just like, it really affected me. And that particular scene, I think Gary Sinise is just such an interesting actor, and his disappointment is so profound. And I remember being really overwhelmed by it. And also that the other men, there's nothing they can do, and they are excited to go to space. Like,
Tom Hanks takes responsibility for it, which is interesting. He was like, it was my decision.
Yeah.
But it wasn't his decision, because he was trying to go to bat for his friend. And so I was thinking about that after. I was thinking, like, after I reviewed the scene in preparation for, you know, for this podcast, I was like giving it some thought. I was like, why did he take responsibility? It would have been so easy to just blame. That's what most people would have done, I guess, because he's a good leader and he's taking responsibility. Yeah. And in a way, he's like, blame me. Don't blame NASA. Like, still pursue being an astronaut. I'm guessing that's the reason why that he said, it's my decision, you know, because it really wasn't his decision. In the scene before that, they're like, here's what's happening. And either you guys either all sit it out. Like, he did give them that option of, okay, you could just sit out this mission, all three of you. But it wasn't really his decision to specifically sit him out. So I thought it was an interesting dynamic that he's like, it was on me, blame me, sort of thing. Even though it really wasn't on him, it was already predetermined. So I thought that was an interesting dynamic of the scene. And you know what's also kind of interesting? There's a parallel there between, like, this whole mission that they're about to do is a parallel for filmmaking completely, right? Like you're getting ready to go, everything's going, and then, like, you might find something out last minute that it's like a fundamental change to, like, your whole plan, and you have to roll with it. You have to roll with it. The train has to be in motion, you know?
Right. Right. Well, I think, and in movies I love, you can't see it happening, but, you know, Gary Sinise in that scene is like, I guess he's not very likable. I mean, I think you have empathy for him, but he seems like he's going to almost be a non-factor in the movie. I mean, he's not going up. And then, of course, the story and the way it's structured, he gets this kind of redemption and gets to kind of be a part of it, even though it's a screwed up situation, but he's necessary, which is part of what he wanted. I don't know. There's just something really beautiful about that kind of arc, but you don't see anything. Yeah.
I thought another Tom Hanks, Gary Sinise movie, Forrest Gump. That's when I first got exposed to Gary Sinise when I was a kid, and just the Lieutenant Dan character, like, what an incredible character arc that is in a motion picture, right? I mean,
he's great.
Yeah,
he plays anger so interestingly, and in the Apollo 13. I haven't seen the scene in a while, but I feel like it kind of, like, builds. Like, he starts off trying to be kind of casual about how upset he is, and then it just is changing, and you're, like, seeing it all in his face. It's like,
no, he's definitely an actor that could internalize things, and then the way he expresses it, it's really interesting. So what's next in the pipeline for you guys? Are you planning on another movie, or
we hope so. You know how it goes.
I do. Unfortunately, I do.
Kicking around. Maybe someday we'll get to make another one. It'd be great.
Yeah, hopefully sooner than later.
Yeah.
And where could people follow along with you guys? You guys on social media, website, or?
Yeah, the movie Mary Goodenough is on Instagram at Mary Goodenough. I don't know why I'm using my hand, but so that, you know, there's clips of the movie and some good fun behind the scenes stuff, and certainly a great place to follow if and when we find a new home, hopefully for this coming Christmas. The actors are really active on social media, so they're super fun to follow. Our lead actress, Rae Levine, Joel Murray, and then there's a website, marygoodenough.com. I'm not that active personally on social media, so.
I think neither are you, Dan. Is that right?
Yeah, no, not super. I did start an Instagram like a week ago, so.
Nice.
Yeah. We're not super.
Late bloomer on the gram.
Yeah, well, I was on there for a time. I got off.
I know how it goes. Yeah. I might be taking a hiatus myself for a while.
Yeah, I mean, if it's deserved, you take it.
Yeah, I think it might be deserved right now. I'm definitely not a person that lives in public. It's a weird thing. Like, social media, I'm sure you guys have given this some thought. I mean, it's, I don't know if human beings, if, like, we've evolved enough biologically to handle the rapid technological changes that have taken place in the last and 15 years. You know,
I heard something kind of wild recently, and I don't know if it's true, but a college professor says that it's true, which was that when the answering machine came about, you know, back in the early 90s or whenever that was happening, most people didn't want one. And they only ended up getting one because, you know,
other people had them.
It was normal.
Yeah, that's funny. I think there's something there for sure.
There's, yeah. I mean, this could become a whole other.
It could become a whole other podcast.
It's just crazy to think the way, you know, we all communicate. Forget social media. Just the ability to text somebody at any time. It's like you used to have to pick up the phone and call somebody.
Yeah.
Which was a serious act in a way.
Right, right. Totally.
Spend nights in your house just like reading, I guess, or like what did people do if they weren't just kind of like bullshit texting their friends all night? I should.
Yeah. And then there's definitely those friends that some friends really get annoyed if you don't respond instantaneously. You know, I'm a person that's a little bit more forgiving of things like that. But some people, I don't know, you know, that sort of instant access. It's like, are we designed to have instant access to everybody at all times?
Right.
I think that's probably,
I don't know.
It's a whole other podcast. But guys, I so appreciate the both of you being on the podcast. Really enjoyed the film. Glad to see that it's on streaming and hope to see more films from the two of you in the near future.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having us. Welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This was awesome.
Thank you for listening to the Film Situation Podcast with your host, Seth Cota. Today's guests were Caroline Keene and Dan Kennedy. Produced by Theodora Harrington. Music by Yuri Ryback.